Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
Another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And some of you may have noticed that we've had a slight change in visual appearance over the last few weeks. I personally have been working on a little side project that turned out to be a rebrand of the Board Game Bros podcast's visual branding. So we have like a new logo, which appears on a new thumbnail for our podcast on all streaming services. And we have a brand new website and new merch. So I'd just like to take a second at the top of this show to check out the post on our website if you want to know more about it. There's just a little bit more there with a link to a little Behance post for you to check out all the details. And you can also find on our website a link to TeePublic, where we have our new merch posted. So check it out.
Also, I just want to say probably my favorite part about this new website is the addition of a search bar.
Oh, yeah. We were sorely missing out on up till now. So we have a search bar on our website, and you can use that to find episodes where we talk about games. So
such as the precursor to the game we're talking about today.
Excellent, excellent tie-in. Yes, so today we are talking about a game that we've talked about before. Recently, we've acquired an expansion for this game, and quite a substantial expansion at that. So if you want to listen to our original episode, Matthew, tell them what they can put in the search bar.
Well, you can search for Spirit Island, because today we are talking about Spirit Island Jagged Earth, designed by R. Eric Royce. And released in 2020 by Greater Than Games. Technically, we're also talking about Branch and Claw. The two expansions are, they share a lot of mechanics. So they're kind of like wrapped in together in one here.
Right. And I don't believe we've talked about the Branch and Claw expansion, because mostly because it's a pretty small expansion. And as far as new game components goes, I guess they did add a couple interesting things like events. We'll go into the difference between the two and just how massive this new expansion is.
I mean,
at least that's the way it feels.
In terms of like variety from the original, Branch and Claw added a lot, but it didn't add a lot of things that you choose before you play the game.
Right.
Such as spirits.
Okay, so without any further ado, we're going to get into discussion on Spirit Island and its expansions. I think we're going to start the way we usually do, talking about the game. We won't spend as much time as we do in the original episode, but we'll still hit on all the important details. Then we'll talk about strategy, especially as it pertains to the new spirits. And then finally, we'll talk about design. So to start off with a short explanation of what Spirit Island is about, the core of the game doesn't change as you add these expansions. So in Spirit Island, players cooperate to protect an island and its inhabitants from invading colonists with powers and careful planning. Each turn starts with the spirit phase, at the start of which each player may spread their presence on the island and grow more powerful. Each player then decides which power cards to play for the turn, paying the energy cost for those power cards at this point. Next, the island phase occurs. During the island phase, first, fast powers take effect. Then the invaders ravage, build, and explore the island. And then finally, slow powers take effect. If the invaders dealt too much damage during their ravaging, blight is added to the island, which destroys spirit's presence as a result. When too much blight is added to the island, or all of one spirit's presence is totally destroyed from the island, then the spirits lose. If the spirits eliminate all of the invaders, or generate enough fear to unlock a new win condition, then the spirits win. So that is the gist of what Spirit Island is about. There's an island, you're protecting it as spirits with your mystical powers, and you use those powers to destroy invaders, generate fear, or at least displace the invaders so that they don't explore or ravage or build in the lands that they are planning to do so in. So let's go a little bit into the detail on how the game is played, just to paint a picture of all of the elements of this game as we get into the strategy. So I guess first we can start talking about at the very beginning of setup, you have to choose a spirit, and each spirit comes with slightly different setup instructions and a hand of four powers, which they begin with. Power cards, I should specify. There's other elements in this game that are called powers, but they are not in the form of cards. Power cards are powers. So each spirit starts with four power cards and a different setup rules. And then each spirit has different powers baked into their player boards, as well as their own unique growth options. So growth is how you add presents to the board. Presents are these little wooden pieces that you can play in the lands. The lands are the sort of individual territories of a board. And all the boards, by the way, are connected together, sort of like a tessellating shape to create the island. We should get that out of the way. So each spirit has its own unique growth options that will add presents. They'll gain power cards. They will reclaim cards, because after you play a power card, it goes to a temporary discard pile, and you only get those cards back when you use a reclaim cards action. And then your growth options may also give you energy, which energy, by the way, is the currency in this game that you spend as a spirit to play cards. Each spirit has its own presence tracker. Each presence tracker is different. It usually has two rows, one for energy per turn and one for card plays. After you've chosen your growth option, you look at your presence tracker, see how much energy per turn you acquire based on what the most recent presence space you've uncovered is. And then see how many cards you can play for that turn based on what the most recent card play space you've uncovered is. So that'll typically be, you know, anywhere from like 1 to 4 energy maybe gained, and then 1 to 3 card plays, maybe more, depends on the spirit you're playing. So after you have examined those and acquired the energy for the turn, you then choose which cards you want to play from your hand, and you can only play a number of cards equal to whatever your card play tracker is at. Every spirit does this at the same time and communicates with each other so that each spirit knows what the other spirits are planning to do, and it helps the spirits coordinate which parts of the board they are planning to affect with their powers, and which parts of the board they can't affect and therefore may need help from other spirits with.
Yes, this is a cooperative game.
Yes, this is a cooperative game, if I hadn't made that clear yet.
Also, so, every power card has elements on it. These, I believe there are 8 or so, but these are like different natural element symbols represented by a color and a symbol. And some powers will check how many elements you have and then gain a special effect based on that. The most notable of which is your spirit's innate powers, which are beneath your growth track on your spirit board. Mm-hmm. These you can do every turn or every round, as long as the cards you've played create enough element symbols to activate them.
Yeah, it's sort of like each power typically has a couple of levels to it, and you unlock higher, more effective levels of that power the more elements you have. And these elements typically come from the cards like you mentioned. So if you need, like, say, 2 sun elements and 2 moon elements for an innate power, that typically means you had to have played 2 cards. However, sometimes you can receive elements from your presence track, your growth trackers. Sometimes you can receive them from your growth option. And sometimes cards will give players temporary elements. If anything ever changes about your character mid-turn, then you can use that turn. So if you gain an element as like a fast action, then you can use that element as a slow action or even as another fast action, you know, after it's been given to you, you know, in that moment. The only thing you really can't do is you can't pay for a card with presents that you've received from like a fast action, because you pay for cards before any powers take effect. And when I say fast action, I mean fast power.
Sorry.
Every action in this game comes from a power.
What happens when you gain an elephant?
You about 10 pounds.
Nice. You mentioned fast powers. This is because the powers you play don't actually take effect until everyone's choosing which powers they want to play. And then the rest of the turn occurs. There is
the island phase.
Right, there is a phase where all the fast powers, which are indicated by a little bird symbol on the power, when those take effect, and then the invader phase happens where the invaders take their actions, and then once the invaders are done taking actions is when slow effects happen, represented by a turtle.
Right, let's see. So that's and then after all that happens, then time passes, which is just to say It's just you checking with all the other spirits to make sure everyone did everything that they set out to do. And then you move on to the next turn, starting again with the spirit phase, which begins with growth. So mixed in there, there's a couple extra things that could happen on a turn. If you're playing with events, which you probably are if you're using the expansions of this game, especially I think events were introduced in the Branch and Claw expansion, and then there a couple extras were added in Jagged Earth. Events happen before, they happen after the spirit's fast powers have resolved, but before the invaders ravage. And then also in between the events and the invaders is fear cards, which is a game element we haven't talked about. So as you destroy invaders and after playing certain powers, you will gather fear. There is a pool of fear tokens. There's four per player in any given game. And every time you empty the pool of fear tokens, there's a deck of nine fear cards. You take the top card of the fear card and place it into like a sort of holding location where you wait until it's time to reveal what it does, which is now in the turn order between events and the invader actions. You flip the fear card face up, and generally it lets every spirit take an action that's beneficial to them, generally. It's typically worded to occur once on each board or once per spirit in lands where certain conditions are met. But again, it's generally a good thing for a spirit whenever a fear card resolves. Now, one important thing about fear cards is that after you have drawn three fear cards from the top of the deck, that's by emptying the pool of fear tokens three times. By the way, whenever you empty the fear pool, it resets. And if you had like leftover fear, you continue to remove tokens from the fear pool. So after every three fear cards are drawn from the top of the deck, you unlock a new fear level, or terror level, I believe is the proper term for it. And the terror level changes the win condition for the spirits. So at the start of the game, the win condition is you have to destroy all of the invaders' villagers, towns, and cities. But if you draw three, then that just changes to towns and cities. You don't have to worry about the villagers being all destroyed anymore. Once more, you unlock the, it's just cities that you have to destroy. You can forget worrying about towns as far as winning is concerned. And then if you get the last three fear cards, then you won the game. You win the game if you can draw all nine fear cards. So we're talking about towns and cities. So I suppose it's now time we should talk about the invaders and what they do.
Make it real quick so we can talk about the new stuff.
Yes. So I'll make it super quick. How about that? So first, invaders explore. When you invader explores, you look at all, they're always going to explore to a land of a particular terrain type. The terrain types are wetlands, sands, jungles, and mountains. There's also oceans, which are on the edges of the board. They're not a terrain type. You don't generally care about them for most of the game, except when they explore to every land of the matching terrain type that is either next to the ocean or next to a land that has invaders in it already. Okay, and when they explore, you just put one villager in that land. The villager is the smallest invader piece. Then the next invader action is they build. I'm saying these in reverse order as they happen on a turn, but this is the order that they take place over multiple turns. So on turn one, they explore. Turn two, they'll build in the land that they had explored in. So if they explored into jungles, then you go to turn two. You look at every jungle. You see if it has invaders. If it does, then a building gets built. If there are more cities, if the number of cities is equal to or greater than the number of villages, then you build a village. If not, you build a city. So generally, an explorer in an empty land will build a village, which is the second largest invader piece. And then if there's like just an invader in a village, they'll build a city, and the city is the largest invader piece. So on turn three, they ravage. When invaders ravage, villagers deal one damage, villages deal two damage, or towns, I guess you could call them. Villagers, towns deal two, cities deal three damage. The damage is dealt simultaneously to the land itself and to any Dayhan in the land. The Dayhan are the native islanders who live on the island, in Spirit Island. They're represented by little wooden huts. So they deal damage to both. The huts have two health, By the way, every invader has health equal to however much damage it does. So villagers 1, towns 2, cities 3. If that damage that they dealt just there was 2 or greater, then they add a blight to the land. Blight is the loss condition for spirits. If too much blight gets added to the island, then spirits lose. If blight gets added to a land, any spirit who had presence there loses 1 presence. It's destroyed. And then also, if there was already a blight there, then it cascades to another adjacent land. Let's see. After the invaders deal damage, if there's any surviving Dayhand, each surviving Dayhand deals 2 damage back to the invaders. So that can, you know, help counterattack, turn the tides.
And it should be noted that the amount of health each invader piece has is the same as the amount of damage they deal. So mm-hmm. a town has 2 health, a city has 3, 1 invader has 1. So, for example, 1 Dayhand can destroy 1 town in a counterattack. Yeah.
So whenever a town or a city is destroyed, they generate or the spirits generate 1 or 2 fear, respectively. So 1 fear when a town is destroyed, 2 fear is when a city is destroyed. This is the most common way of generating fear, other than cards that just give you flat amounts of fear when you play them, or powers that give you fear. But generally, you generate a lot of fear from destroying towns and cities. Okay, that's what the invaders do. And just so you know, so that's how that happens over 3 turns. This is represented by a card moving along a tracker. So you'll draw like the wetland card. They'll explore the wetlands that turn. You move it along the tracker. They build in wetlands. You move it along the tracker. They ravage in wetlands. However, during any given turn, they're affecting 3 different terrains. So there'll be like a card in the ravage section, a card in the build section, and a card in the explore section, and that all 3 of those happen on any given turn in ravage, build, explore order. So they ravage first, then they build in the build terrain, then they explore in the newly drawn explore terrain. It should be noted that you don't know what terrain they're about to explore to at the beginning of a turn. You have to guess.
It should also be noted that you lose if every card in the invader deck is drawn.
Right. So there's 3 + 4 + 5, that's 12 cards in the invader deck. And if, yes, after 12 turns, the game ends and spirits lose. Unless, yeah, that's
okay.
Let's see.
So new mechanics.
What else does there to talk about? New mechanics. So there's events. Like we mentioned, you draw them at the beginning of the invader phase, right before you draw fear cards, if you have any, or reveal fear cards, I should say. And events typically have either a set effect that happens depending on what terror level you're at, what phase of the invaders deck you're at. It gets progressively more complicated. But anyways, so there's either just like a random event that just happens. Sometimes there's a choice where players will get to choose whether one thing or another happens, and they'll oftentimes have to pay energy that they have left over to get the better of the 2 choices. And then every event will have extra bonus effects that could be positive or negative towards the spirits. Generally, the main effects are negative towards the spirits, and then the rest is like even mixture, positive, negative. But it's usually just sort of in there to throw a wrench in everyone's plan. So it's a small wrench, not a big one.
Right. Many of those side effects, they rely on different tokens that were added in Branching Claw and Jagged Earth. Mm-hmm. There are a total of 5 unique tokens, 4 of which were added in Branching Claw, 1 was added in Jagged Earth. I think we should start with the 3 simplest ones. Mm-hmm. So, 1 token is Wilds, which represent, like, overgrown land. These prevent the first explore to happen into that territory. And then,
it should be mentioned, every token is placed in a territory except for Strife, which we'll get to.
Right. So Wilds are placed in a territory, and when the invaders would explore into that territory, you skip that and remove that Wilds token.
Mm-hmm.
Disease represents disease. Kind of looks like a little snake. And the way disease works is you put it in a territory, and the first time a build would happen in that territory, you remove the disease and skip it.
Right. Similar to Wilds.
Right. Now, Strife is, it is similar where it skips ravages, but the way it works is you put the Strife on an invader piece, whether that's a city, town, or villager. or invader, I mean. And then when the ravage happens, every piece with a strife gets skipped, and then the strife is removed.
Right. So it skips strife action, but only for one particular piece.
Now, if multiple pieces have strife, then all those pieces skip it, but pieces without strife will still attack.
In that territory.
Yes.
Beasts are the fourth piece that was added. All three of those were added in Branch and Claw. Beasts were also added in Branch and Claw. Beast tokens don't have any inherent effects. However, a number of powers in the game, both spirits, innate powers, and powers in the deck, power cards, care about beasts. So having them present will change the effect of different powers, or certain powers won't do anything unless there are beasts present.
Right. Beasts also are very common in the side effects of events.
Mm-hmm. And then the final token, which was added in Jagged Earth, is called Badlands. And the way that a Badland token works is it's put inside a territory, and whenever damage would be dealt in that territory, you add one. Spirit? The first time each action damages invaders in a land, increase that damage by one per Badlands.
Okay.
The first time each action damages Dayhan in a land, increase that damage by one per Badlands. So it only increases damage from actions. It doesn't increase the damage from the invaders. So that's just saying whenever you see like a number on a card saying that it's dealing damage, so like a card says deal 3 damage, every Badlands token in a land increments that number by 1. So a 3 becomes 4 if there's one Badlands.
Right.
So those are the tokens. And then even though beasts, a lot of effects care about beasts, that's not to say that the other tokens don't have the same relationship with powers. There's a number of powers and spirits in the game that also care about the wilds or the beasts or the disease or Badlands.
Right. So with disease, it does start with one disease on the board on every board, I mean, that on the territory that starts with a city. And then where does the beast go during setup?
Beast goes in the highest number land with no setup icons on it.
Right. And then there is no setup for disease, strife, and badlands. Or sorry, for strife, wilds, and badlands. Right. Those they are only placed by other means.
Exactly. I guess the last thing we have to talk about mechanics-wise and component-wise is there's added in Branch and Claw are these element tokens. They're used in a number of applications. And each time they're used, it's generally explained on, you know, someone's spirit or a scenario or something. So it's kind of a versatile piece. But occasionally a player can just use them to track what elements they have, because sometimes it can be a little difficult to do that. So you can do that with the element tokens. But generally, whenever you use an element token, which will have one of the 8 elements that you see on the sides of cards, the rules will be explained whenever the game is asking you to use them.
Right.
So like sometimes you use them and they can only be used for one power. Sometimes you gain them and you place them on the board in a certain way.
There is one more mechanic, though, that we haven't really messed with, admittedly, which is that in Jagged Earth, they added aspects for the original 4 low complexity spirits. These are replacement rules, typically replacement innate powers, that you kind of lay over your spirit board as sort of an alternate option for that spirit. So like if you've played a lot of lightning from the base set, you can mess around with this alternate version of lightning.
Mm-hmm. All right. We haven't played with those, admittedly, so that's something we can check out in the future. But that is an element in the Jagged Earth expansion. Okay. So I want to go real quick through my best tips for any Spirit Island playthrough. Just the general best practices, best like rule of thumb strategy tips I can give to get those out of the way.
Yeah.
Okay. So on any given turn, first of all, you're generally looking at either trying to remove a villager from a land with a fax action, therefore it won't build. Or B, you're trying to remove a town that a villager builds after it's been built on that turn with a slow action. So fast actions, you want to move villagers that are about to build. Slow actions, you want to move towns that are about to build. Everything else in this game is either speculating where someone's going to explore, which is hard to do, or it's like putting a Band-Aid on something that's an emergency, like stopping a big ravage that's about to happen with a fast action. Fast actions are generally weak. slow actions are generally stronger, so you really want to focus on what's being built and either stopping the build or destroying it after it's been built, because the goal of any given action is to just leave it with one or zero damage so that no blight gets added. Okay. So that's tip number one, either remove the villager before they build or remove the town after it's been built on any given turn. Let's see.
Second
tip, try to isolate a land. Isolate is actually a mechanic in the game now, but when I say isolate, what I mean is that when invaders would explore to it, they can't because there is not an adjacent land with explorers or with invaders in it. So if you can do this, this has like cascading effects. This means that they won't explore there, so they won't build there, so they won't ravage there. So all of your resources can be put to the other lands on the board. This is a huge tempo swing for the players. So that's tip number two. Try and isolate a board. If you can, your victory is almost assured. Third tip is don't panic. You start out weak, much weaker than the invaders can expand. You can do much less than what the invaders are doing. You catch up to them eventually. So at the start of the game, don't panic. Don't start freaking out about which territories are going to be ravaged and how blight is about to be added to the board. You know, it's okay to add blight to the board. It's okay for your presence to be destroyed as a result sparingly. You obviously don't want things to get out of hand, but it's going to happen. So just be patient, continue to expand your presence, grow your strengths as your spirit, and then you will catch up and then eventually overtake what the invaders are doing. So tip three, don't panic.
Right. My main tip is that blight is a resource, much like mm-hmm. health in many games. The thing about blight is that you don't lose until the last blight is removed. And even then, you don't really get into a problem territory until you've gone out of Healthy Island, which is when the original blight pool is all depleted. Mm-hmm. So if you're between, being able to play a pretty powerful turn on your slow actions or spending all your energy and resources to do, to protect one territory as fast actions, it might be better to play the long term and let a territory take blight. This is especially true if nobody has presence there and if there aren't any Dayhand there. If there's just a bunch of buildings somewhere, they can only get one blight even if they deal 10 damage to that territory. So it might be better to sort of concentrate your efforts on other places to stop them from branching out too far. You can always come to that territory later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's an inevitable point in every game of Spirit Island where early on you draw the terrain card where the city started in on your board. So the city is going to gain a villager and a town, and then that's 6 health that you have to deal with. Generally, when this happens, on the first 3 turns of the game, you just let it go. Just let it out of blight, especially because pretty much on every board, the city starts in a territory that doesn't have blight. So you don't even have to worry about the cascade. Okay, so general rules of thumb. I think there's one that I personally have trouble sticking to, but I think it's important to not tunnel so hard on the cards in your discard, and try spending at least one turn, every game where you think you should reclaim cards, instead adding presence and drawing more cards. Because sometimes you'll figure out one of your cards is very effective and you'll think, oh, I can reclaim it next turn and then play it again and always have access to that card. But if you're reclaiming, that means that your spirit isn't usually growing in strength. And so that point where you can overtake the invader's effectiveness happens much later in the game. So try not to focus too hard on the cards you have. Consider adding presence to the board and drawing new powers.
Right. I want to talk about kind of how to use the new tokens.
Okay.
So first off, obviously play to your spirit. If you have a mm-hmm. spirit that revolves around using tokens, then just follow that. Mm-hmm. But in general, so I think Wilds is strong. If you're able to place it, I think early game, it's strong on inland territories. In late game, it's strong on coastal territories. Mm-hmm. This is because in the third invader tier of cards, you start to get cards that affect every coastal territory.
That's actually in the second
tier. Really?
Yeah, Coastal first appears in the second tier. But yeah, Coastal is a real difficult card to draw because there's only two of any given terrain type on at least the basic side of all the player boards. There's like a reverse, like thematic side, which is a little more complicated. But we're just talking about the basic side here of the island boards. There's two of every territory. So if you draw a wetland card, then at most, two territories on every board are going to get explored too. However, there's three coastal territories on every board, and they're always going to get explored too. So when you draw coastal, not only are all invaders going to go there, but they're going to go there every time. Like there's never no way to isolate them. And there's three of them, more than two. Anyways, right. So yes, on the coast is where you want wilds to be at the mid to late game.
Right. So disease is pretty strong anywhere, but I think it's especially useful to put them in places with towns. This is pretty much just because there are... It feels like there are way more cards that can directly affect towns than there are cards that directly affect cities. And mm-hmm. So putting disease in places where cities will be built prevents those from happening so that you can use your cards more effectively.
Right.
Like limiting it so that the invaders are mostly towns.
Yeah. Not only are you stopping a harder building to destroy from being built, but there's many other cascading effects from having more towns than cities at any given point.
Strife, I think, it's obviously good on cities or towns.
Yeah.
Slow strife effects are really good because you can plan ahead for the next ravage phase. Usually that means you can put them on the most valuable sort of piece.
Going back to the rule of thumb, you can put the slow strife effect on the building that just got built, so then there's just an invader there doing the ravaging.
What's especially good is the combo between strife and Dayhan. I believe strife does not skip the invader like ravage action, it just skips the damage they deal, which means that the Dayhan still gets a counterattack in territories with strife.
Right.
And so that means that if you put strife on a city in a territory with two Dayhan, those Dayhan can counterattack and kill that city with no risk. Animals, they are usually best in territories with invaders. This right. is sort of how it feels based on my experiences with both spirits that use animals, minor powers that use animals, and events that use animals.
And then Badlands are just generally good everywhere, but also primarily in lands with invaders, especially those really big lands that have like tons of invaders growing in them, so that damage has a place to spread to.
Right.
It's obviously there's no point in adding one damage to a card that deals one damage when you're just trying to kill an invader.
Right.
Let's see. What other strategy elements can we talk about?
I have a few from some of the spirits I played.
Okay. I think, yeah, I guess you can go over that if you want to point out a couple things.
Sure. So I've played three spirits out of the new spirits between the two sets. So I guess I'll just go ahead and talk about them real quick. These are just kind of like bullet points.
Okay.
So one spirit is Trickster. This is a spirit that is really good at adding strife to different pieces. They also have a bit of randomness, but the randomness is usually fine. There was a thread on BoardGameGeek that calculated it. Specifically, it's a card that you play it, you destroy a town, and then you reveal the top card of the minor power deck and discard it. And if that card had a fire element, you add a blight and deal extra damage. The BoardGameGeek user found that, like, calculating every card in the deck, a good rule of thumb is to expect every other card to add a blight. Unless you have other players who are actively digging through the deck and, like, taking cards with fire elements. So one thing that's really helpful is if you're playing Trickster, to play with another player who wants fire element cards. Otherwise, Trickster is really good at stalling their own board. They can really easily prevent ravages from happening on their board, but they don't have great ways to deal with cities. The next spirit I played was Fractured Moments in Time or something like that. Fractured Sky. I call it time, but it's not actually time.
Called Fractured Days Split the Sky.
Yeah. So Fractured Days is really interesting because it has a lot of really unique mechanics. The one I want to mention is that it has a card that can repeat invader cards. It's like you replace the top card of the invader deck with one from the invader discard that is within one level of it. So if you're in level 3 invaders, you can't put in level 1 invaders back, but you should prioritize repeating the level 1 invader cards in level 2 so that you skip any possible, like, coastal invaders or, you know, any of the really difficult stuff. Also, what's worth noting is that Fractured has an ability to look at the top invader card and then randomize it with the bottom one. Or not the bottom one, the next one afterwards. So, like, you take the top one, look at it, you can tell your teammates what it is, then you shuffle that with the other card on top. So basically, you know what one of the top two cards will be. And this is pretty useful because, for one thing, if the card that you saw didn't come up, then you know that it will come up next. But also, you can kind of even metagame this further, because if it is the last card in a invader-like level, you can look at it, and then since the card underneath it will be of the next level, when you shuffle them, you can tell which one will be the one you just saw. And then the last spirit that I played was Many Minds Move as One, which has incredible art. That's why I played it. Many Minds was interesting because it mainly functioned as just like a fear engine. I think the reason it worked really well for me was that it couldn't really do damage that well, but it could defend really well. And it, you know, like I said, it generated a lot of fear. I think the benefit of Many Minds in a larger game is that Many Minds is very mobile and can defend a large amount in one spot. So you can, like, play support, kind of, running around to other spirits' boards and helping them defend one spot that turn.
I have a couple. I didn't realize I had tips for the ones I played because they weren't as tricky, I think, as some of the ones, except for I played one called Shroud of Silent Mist, which is a pretty complicated spirit. And my one strategy tip for that is just to reread through the spirit's special rules every turn, because it has four special rules that all change the way your spirit functions compared to a typical spirit. So pay attention to that. It's, you know, it says once per turn when you gain a power card without fire, you gain one energy. I missed that a couple times when I played it. Miss Shift and Flow. The way this spirit works is if you can target lands that you couldn't reach with your presence, because generally all powers target a land that is within a certain distance from your presence or a land with your presence. The Shroud of Silent Mist can move its presence as part of the targeting for each power up to one space, therefore being able to target a space. Like, for example, you can target a space where you don't have presence with a power that has range 0, as long as you can pull a presence from a nearby land into that territory and thereby satisfy the range 0 requirement. But then also, invaders and Dayhand in your lands don't heal damage. That's something to keep in mind all the time. And then finally, during time passes, you generate fear based on how many damaged pieces are in a territory with your unit. So I think at the end of every turn, and maybe even at the beginning of every turn, so just twice every turn, read all of those powers and make sure you're satisfying them and using them to your advantage.
This isn't a spirit I played, but one that one of our players that we had played with played. Mm-hmm. Somebody else played the spirit, but it is Volcano. I want to mention that. So Volcano stacks up presence on a mountain and then can explode onto a territory adjacent to that mountain for a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. What this means is you should try and allow territories near that mountain to build up so that you can clear them all out in one large turn. So, like, you can focus on territories that are not adjacent to Volcano's, like, major stack as far as, like, cards that defend or remove buildings and whatnot, simply because you can sort of do this combo turn where you get a lot of fear from blowing up a giant amount of pieces.
All right. Shifting Memory of the Ages is another one that I played that allows it. Normally, when you gain a power, you choose to either gain a minor power or a major power. Major powers are obviously more effective than minor powers at what they do. They oftentimes cost much more energy to play. And whenever you learn a major power, you have to forget a power from your hand or discard pile for the rest of the game. So you can no longer play that card. But Shifting Memory of the Ages does not forget. So when you gain a major power, you don't have to forget a power. You can instead just discard a power card from your hand. This is good. I think the strategy with this is just to plan 2 to 3 turns ahead, because one of the Shifting Memory of the Ages growth options is just to straight up gain 9 energy. So this allows you to play those very expensive major powers. It also allows you to play those powers and still have some left over for the next turn or the turn after. So plan for that turn where you gain that 9 energy and make sure you're taking the steps in the proper order and in a reasonable amount of time to, you know, gain the major power that you plan to play, and then have other cards to play during that turn, and then, you know, reclaim cards later on when you don't need the energy. So yeah, plan ahead. Same for everything, plan ahead, but definitely for this one, you want to plan those growth options. You want to sequence those growth options properly. And then the other one that I guess I have tips for, I think, is Stone's Unyielding Defiance, which this power, or this spirit's main claim to fame, is that they can pay energy when Blight is added to the island to take the Blight from the box rather than from the Blight card. The Blighted Island or Healthy Island card. So you, it's essentially, if you play with this spirit, your allies gain access to extra Blight. So my one tip is just to save up and take advantage of that every time you can, every chance you get. It's very strong. Good in combination with stuff like Volcano or Vengeance, which is another spirit I played, that tend to allow Blight to be added frequently. It helps to have that buffer.
Right, or reward Blight being added.
Right, and then for some of these that I haven't played or that I have played, like Vengeance, like what am I thinking of? Lure. Just be very aware of where the tokens are. The Badlands, Wild, Strife, Disease. Be very aware of where they are and what they do, and add them as often as you can. And if you can, ask your allies to add them whenever they can.
Right.
All right. There was only two spirits, by the way, added in Branch and Claw. I think I played one of them at some point, but they're not all that complicated. I don't think they require much like tips and tricks to be discussed. There were 10 spirits added in Jagged Earth, for the record.
We didn't even cover all of those.
We didn't cover all of them. And they're quite complex. So let's see. Do you have anything else strategy-wise to discuss before we get into the design discussion on Jagged Earth and Branch and Claw?
Not necessarily, but if you, the listener, have advice for your favorite spirits, then let us know, because I would love to see what other people say about other spirits.
Yeah, I'm very curious, especially with all these new complicated ones. I want to hear the tips and tricks.
Especially Starlight, which we were unable to play.
Yeah, Starlight we didn't play. It's a very intimidating spirit. It's sort of like a build-your-own spirit. It has a ton of different innate powers and growth trees that let you sort of customize what kind of a spirit you're playing over the course of a game.
Build-a-bear.
Okay, before we get into the design discussion, we do some quick plugs. You can follow us on social media, on Facebook and Twitter, at BG Bros Cast. You can see our cool logos there, what's it called? What's your profile icons, profile pictures, whatever, with our cool new logo there. You can go to bgbcast.com. That's our website, just recently redesigned. Use the search bar there to find episodes that you're looking for. You can find a link to our TeePublic store on that website, where we sell our merch with our cool new logo and branding on it. That's teepublic.com/user/bgbcast. And while you're on our website, go over to the episodes and articles tab, check out the post about the rebrand, and go ahead and check out the Behance post while you're at it, if you don't mind, and drop in that a like if you feel like it, if you like the way it looks. And if you have any suggestions for games or comments, you can always hit us up on our socials. That's, again, BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. That does it for BG Bros plugs. Let's hear Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/TWAK. I stream on Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 p.m. Central Time or 4 p.m. somewhere in there. I stream a lot of competitive games, a lot of roguelites. Been playing a lot of Risk of Rain 2 since the update came out. I've been doing some speed runs. So,
I've been meaning to play Risk of Rain with you, by the way.
Yeah.
You gotta hit me up sometime.
So, if you are interested in that, come check it out. I always keep a chill attitude and a very analytical attitude. You can also follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, where I tweet links to anything I work on, anything I do. I tweet when I go live on Twitch, all that. You can also check out my other podcast, NetSurfer Pro. NetSurfer Pro on all podcasting platforms, or NetSurfer Pro Pod at Facebook and Twitter. And it's me and another friend of mine who was on one episode of Board Game Bros talking about sort of any sort of interesting media that we like or we want to share and analyze. This month we are doing Vaporwave Prol, where we're talking about Vaporwave, the sort of music and aesthetic genre.
All right. You can also find me on Twitch at twitch.tv/radicalhawks. That's twitch.tv/radical, H-A-W-K-Z. And I am trying to stream a little more often, sometimes during the day. Still working on a schedule, but follow that channel to get notifications of when I go live. And I'll probably be streaming with Twack here occasionally. And you can find me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs.
Okay.
All right. So design. There's a lot to cover. But I think I want to give a quick overview of Branch and Claw. I just have a couple of high level design notes. I like that token that Branch and Claw added have new control elements. Personally, I enjoy control strategies in this game, like very slow strategies that use a lot of passive defensive options to manage the board and manage the invaders. So I really enjoy all the tokens that got added in Branch and Claw. They all do a similar thing, so they're pretty easy to wrap your head around. And I like that all the elements that care about those tokens, including the two new spirits. And then the events feel pretty well balanced for what they aim to do, which is they aim to add a twist to what happens on any given turn, but it's never purely in the advantage of the invaders or the spirits. It always kind of balances out, comes to even.
I think I want to kind of expand on that really quick.
Sure.
I think there's a lot of games that do these sort of random events. Dead of Winter is a big one that comes to mind. And they usually trend either way, like either inconsequential or like backbreaking or huge. I think what helps these not feel as swingy is that, for one thing, most of them require some sort of choice. And so players can kind of deliberate that. They can decide, you know, to pick their poison. It's not just you're at the whims of the deck completely.
Right.
But also,
if they don't have a choice, by the way, it also just checks what stage of the game, whether it's the early game or the mid game or the late game. So it can sort of balance itself appropriately to where it expects players to be at the time.
Right. Also, the fact that they have these bonus effects often means that they can make a top part that's more devastating, but even it out with the bottom part.
Right. If it wasn't apparent, each event has sort of like two or three parts to it. There's like the top part, like you mentioned, which is kind of like the big effect. And then there's two like smaller effects that, like you mentioned, care about like beast tokens or wild tokens or some token. It's those two parts in combination, the big effect and the little effects, kind of help you. Help the designer balance. They give two knobs that have plenty of room to twist.
Exactly.
Oftentimes against one another.
Yeah. I want to mention that I think it's really funny that the two spirits in Branch and Claw care about branches and claws respectively.
Yeah.
That's like, I'm kind of surprised they didn't do like four spirits because they added four tokens, but I think thematically it's very fitting in a weird way.
Mm-hmm. At least it's satisfying that they made, so there's Keeper of the Forbidden Wilds, which is the Wilds Matter spirit. There's Sharp Fangs Behind the Leaves, which is the Beast Tokens Matter spirit. And then they made the Disease spirit and the Strife spirit in Jagged Earth. So they finished the cycle, at least, which is nice.
Yeah.
The Disease spirit is Vengeance as a Burning Plague, and the like you mentioned, the Strife spirit is the Trickster,
which is my favorite, by the way.
So it's nice that they pulled off that. I just noticed that the two spirits in Branch and Claw have pick two growth options, where you get to choose two amongst four of the growth options, which is, I think, something pretty much unique to those. Except there's one pick two in Jagged Earth, one pick three in Jagged Earth as well, and then there's sort of like a menu one in Jagged Earth, and then there's also the spirit in the base game, which had like always add a presence then pick one. But I want to point this out because the pick two, I think what that does for these two spirits is, since this was like kind of the first expansion chronologically, Branch and Claw came out before Jagged Earth, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So So they're adding these new things, these new complexities. It's nice that they help the player, giving this slightly less, I believe, less complex or at least more versatile growth option, so that it's like one less thing you have to worry about. At least it makes the spirit run a little smoother when you can mix and match the growth options that you need. I think that was a smart move to make the growth option this pick two for both of these spirits.
Right, yeah. You get a lot of flexibility, which helps kind of ease you into it.
Yeah, you can sort of work backwards from, like, what am I trying to do with all this new stuff into which two growth options do I need to pick to accomplish that.
Right. Early game for a lot of spirits, in the base game at least, there are a lot of situations where, like, you need to combo a specific growth option and a specific card play, but... With the multiple choice, you get the ability to combo that and then still have something extra of your choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's generally how they're kind of designed. So I want to say sort of what makes a good expansion.
Okay.
I think we've only talked about expansions in one other episode than this, if I remember correctly.
Other than the series we did in the first year of our podcast.
Oh, right.
Where we covered... for every week of a month, a different board game expansion.
That's right. So this is sort of a topic we've touched on before, but we haven't for a while. So yep. With expansions, I think you kind of want to justify the expansion. There's definitely good expansions that kind of present more of the same, but most expansions tend to add something new, or they like break new ground, or they introduce new mechanics. It's sort of a scale of familiarity to new. You don't want too much new generally, because then it feels really separated from the base game. And then you can have a lot of familiarity, but I think a lot of games nowadays will go for somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
This is really present with like Branch and Claw. The events allow you to experience the new mechanics, even if you don't use the new spirits, since spirits tend to front load a lot of complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And the new tokens in Branch and Claw interact with the invader phase in a way that's pretty easy to understand. And they all, or like the animals follow the same movement rules as Dayhan or invaders. So like placing the tokens might be new powers and stuff, but generally they're easy to understand once they're on the board.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is also helpful that you only place two of them at setup, because in many games you'll only care about two types of tokens that way. So with somebody's first interaction with these new tokens might only be with disease and animals, and then in another game they can learn about strife or wilds.
I found oftentimes animals don't really even factor into a game unless there's a spirit that kind of cares about them.
Right. They even kind of point that out in the rulebook. Like, if you're not playing with events or spirits that use animals, you can put this down instead of an animal.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's like they have these new mechanics, and then they separate them into like sort of easy to understand methods, and then they let you kind of add in the spirits that play with them harder at your leisure.
Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to categorize Branch and Claw as like a sort of slow ramp in complexity, with the elements it's introducing, and the spirits you have access to, whether or not you use them, and how they are just naturally introduced to the game by the new setup rules and shuffling some new cards into the power decks, and then the inclusion of the events. And all of that complexity doesn't necessarily come out as being more difficult or less difficult. The tokens give spirits like new things that they can do besides just directly influencing the invaders with their powers, and you start with some of them on the board, so it's sort of like a little allowance. A little like, we know it might be a little more complicated and therefore a little more difficult, so we're actually giving you, you know, these two disease tokens for free. And that'll be a little buffer for you. It'll help you learn, and it'll keep you safe for a couple turns. Now compare that to Jagged Earth. Jagged Earth is like, it's like puts you on the edge of a diving board and just says, like, when you're ready, just jump. It's going to get wild. Because Jagged Earth's complexity is like staggering, at least when it comes to the spirits. Which it adds all the other stuff that got added. You know, it adds more events, more fear cards. more powers into the power deck, some of them caring about the new element tokens, others just doing whatever. But the spirits are the main focus on Jagged Earth, and their complexity goes like through the roof.
Right. I don't think the base game has any very high complexity.
They definitely don't have any high. The base game has two high complexity characters. They are actually, no, just one. And it's Bringer of Dreams and Nightmares. Oh, no, it has two. Sorry. Oceans, Hungry Grasp, and Bringer of Dreams and Nightmares are two high complexity spirits in the base game. If you compare them, they are definitely moderate complexity by the new scales. Like, there's been some complexity ramp.
Right.
Some complexity creep over Jagged Earth.
It definitely feels like they recognize that Fractured Days and Starlight are really complex. Because, again, those are, like, the first very complex spirits in terms of difficulty to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas all the other spirits are, like, high or moderate. There aren't any low-complexity spirits in Jagged Earth.
Right. And to be fair, there aren't any in Branch and Claw, but there's only two. And those two are moderate. I think moderate is a relatively fair... moderate to low is maybe where I'd put them now. Yeah. When they say high complexity, they mean it now in Jagged Earth.
Right. I think the way I would put it is complexity is more of a case of how many rules are unique to that spirit. So, like,
yes.
I think if you look at Trickster, again, because I played a lot of Trickster, Trickster doesn't have many completely unique rules. Like, they add Strife, they have this sort of random flipping the top card thing, but they don't do a whole lot else that's that unique to them. Compared to something like Fractured Days, which has a toolbox of power cards that you can draw from, and you build up element tokens that you can spend on things. Or Fractured Spirits is the only one that lets you increase the number of times invader actions happen on a board.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the sort of focus they have then is separating spirits into new mechanics you have to learn only for the spirit versus ones that are more... the mechanics you'll learn playing the spirit are general or are more widely applicable.
I think another way of thinking about it, the complexity of these new spirits, is how much you have to keep in mind when you're planning your turnout. So, like, beyond just like what the invaders are doing, like a number of spirits, like the Mists one, has to keep in mind that their presence can move before they play their power cards. So not only can you reach wherever your presence is, but you can reach wherever your presence could be. A number of other spirits are cognizant about, like, disease and animals, like we've mentioned, but the disease and animals are a little bit more mobile than usual, and they also sometimes care about Badlands and Blight in unique ways.
I think,
yeah, compare that to like Keeper of the Forbidden Wilds, which is something where you'd think like you'd have to care about wilds, but none of its abilities really act off of whether a land has wilds. They just sometimes add wilds. And then it's Sharp Fangs, their presence can move with beasts. I think that's more of the complexity that Jagged Earth has, but in addition to having that your presence may move with beasts, they have like a ton of other like new mechanics that you have to keep in mind.
Right. So I think there is still some amount of like on-ramping, but Jagged Earth and Branch and Claw both make use of the fact that you're kind of expected to have played the base game.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, if somebody goes to like play in a play group and somebody else in their group brought Spirit Island and the expansion, then, you know, in that scenario, you're not expected to play the base game before. But the reason why they make these really complex spirits is because the person who's buying Jagged Earth more than likely has already played the base game. And so when they're buying a new set of spirits,
mm-hmm.
they're either probably looking for a challenge or something that is pretty different from what they have at the start.
Sure. I think Spirit Island knows its consumer in this case. They know that a player who already cares enough about a game like Spirit Island, who wants to buy more expansions, has a flair for complicated games. Spirit Island in itself is quite a complicated game inherently, just as the base game. So they're probably looking for a little bit more complexity to add to their game. And so they, because they know this, that's why they can go so hog wild with their complex new mechanics, because they know that the player wants that. The player who's looking to their target consumer wants what they're selling.
Here. Right. It's also worth noting that in this sort of hypothetical where somebody buys both games, both the base and the expansions, the low complexity spirits still exist. So yes. Instead of thinking of it like everybody who's buying Jagged Earth can only play Jagged Earth, it's more like the designers view it as a whole when they think about sort of on-ramping or, you know, difficulty levels. And I think that's pretty common as well in expansions, is that the expansion exists in context with the base game. And so you can design around the idea that even if people haven't played either, they can start with what's in the base game.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Not only do they know who they're designing for, but even just in general, they're designing with the base game in mind. There's still that on-ramping that's been done or that will be done by the base game.
Right.
That onboarding. I want to talk a little bit about psychographics, which is something we haven't talked about in a while on this podcast, the topic of player psychographics and the three common psychographics as devised by Magic the Gathering researchers,
if you don't mind,
and developers. Okay, so there's three sort of common psychographics, you could call them, for players with regards to like a game's mechanics, I guess, because they're not the flavor ones.
Yeah, it's sort of how players interact with the game.
Interact with the
game. What enjoyment they get from interacting with the game.
Specifically from its mechanics.
Right.
From what I gather. Because there's like more flavory type. Anyways, okay. So there's Timmy Tammy, who they like big experiences. There's Johnny Jenny, who they like figuring the game out and playing with its pieces.
They're like puzzlers.
And then there's Spike, who likes to win. Okay, so one thing that Jagged Earth does, obviously, Branch and Claw didn't have enough spirits to really do this, but one thing that Jagged Earth has done with its 10 new spirits is it's given each of these psychographics multiple spirits at different complexity levels, which I think is a very smart thing. So just to go across them, a Johnny Jenny, let's see, where did I write that? Sorry, a Timmy Tammy. Would like spirits like memory, which is the major powers matter. They would like playing major powers. That's obvious one there. Volcano is a very Timmy Tammy spirit. The making a big pile of presence and then destroying it and erupting and dealing a ton of damage to adjacent spaces. Trickster, I think, is a pretty Timmy Tammy spirit, yeah, in my opinion, because of the random events. The other two psychographics would rather plan for that sort of thing. Timmy Tammy just goes for it to see what happens.
Exactly. That's literally the name of the innate power.
Yes. Go for it. See what happens. Johnny Jenny, I believe, would like Starlight, which is, the build your own spirit. Cause they like playing with the pieces. This is the spirit made entirely out of pieces. They'd also like the Fractured Sky one, because they get to build that extra deck and play with it.
There's a lot of like things that are posed as questions, like in what circumstance would it be good to double the amount of invader actions a board takes?
Mm-hmm.
In those sort of questions of asking the player to break them is what Johnny Jenny likes.
I think they would also like Lure of the Deep Wilderness. It has a lot to do with replacing pieces, replacing invader pieces, like replacing towns and villages with invaders. And also, Lure of the Deep Wilderness cares about all token types that be placed in land, in different lands. So I think a Johnny would enjoy messing with each of those tokens in different contexts. And then Spike, among other, I assume Spike would like to win with any given spirit, but Many Minds, move as one, is definitely one that has like just one very unique mechanic to them that a Spike would like to optimize. Same with Mists, or actually Mists has a ton of unique mechanics that I think Mists is more about optimizing than figuring out. Lure, I think they would like. I think they'd also like Fractured. Let's see, Vengeance. Which one is that one?
Vengeance.
That's the hyper defensive one. So yeah, I think there's each of those lists of spirits that I attributed to every psychographic. And I think it's pretty obvious, like, which spirits kind of appeal to which psychographic personally. They have a variety of complexity. So there's the moderate complexity one in Jagged Earth, for the Timmy. And then if they like that, so they can move up to the high complexity one. And then I think also the higher complexity you go, the more that it sort of appeals a little bit more broadly. I think there's definitely something about high complexity that appeals more to a Johnny Jenny for like high complexity means a lot of stuff to work with, or a Spike high complexity is sort of like a challenge for them to overcome.
Right.
But still, there's still stuff in there for all of them. But even still, because each one slants, you know, you can attribute it, and there's all these different complexity levels to approach. I think that's a good quality to have about this game.
Right.
About a game like this.
It definitely recognizes that there are a lot of different people that will play the game. And so it kind of appeals to the multiple things. Mm-hmm. You know, the reason why psychographics are useful is maybe not that they're not like guaranteed 100%, but they're sort of good targets to aim for.
Yeah.
I want to mention that I still love this game's graphic design. I think it does a lot of, I mean, the obvious thing is it does symbols a lot, which is, I mean, it's at least accessible.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that player pieces, like presents, that they're like color coded is a little awkward, but like elements all have symbols. You know, different timings all have symbols. All the tokens have very unique symbols. My favorite thing though is that every component added to the game in an expansion has an expansion symbol, including they have events that are added in Jagged Earth, but only use mechanics from Branch and Claw. And those have a separate symbol to both the Branch and Claw expansion and the Jagged Earth expansion. So they've kind of created this alternate symbol just for people that want to include those events without fully incorporating Jagged Earth.
Right.
And so, to me, including that in the rulebook kind of encourages players to on-ramp themselves, or like work their way through to the new content at a sort of comfortable pace. I think of it like it's a cool idea to be like, here's an expansion, you should probably work your way up as if it were sort of a normal difficulty curve, if you will. But it's easy to forget that. So the designers kind of add this symbol there that puts the idea in the player's head. It inceptions them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a good example of a mechanic where, or it's not really a mechanic, but it's like, it's a suggestion to the players that you kind of encourage to the players through your design, whether that's graphic design or game design.
I want to say that personally, I'm only just now noticing this. Do they mention that in the rule book, the sort of new set symbols and their meaning?
Exactly.
Okay, so, oh, yeah, they do. Page three, technically, if you count the covers, page one. So, yeah, they have like the regular, the plain mountain, the smoking volcano, and the active volcano to explain how to use that expansion. I think that's great. And that leads sort of into my point I was going to wrap up with, or my last point for this discussion, which is that I enjoy big complexity ramps and expansions. Because I think the expansion is the place to add your most complex thoughts and ideas, to, you know, put it there for the player that wants it, but not incorporating it and force, a new player or a player who doesn't want to deal with the complexity, to reckon with it. But I think setting expectations, as in many aspects of life is very important. And so setting the player's expectations for how complex a thing is and how you should try and approach it for the best experience is very good practice as a game designer. So I applaud Spirit Islands, Jagged Earth for that page that explains how you can approach it using the set symbols that they've laid out for you. In addition to their grasp on how complex every spirit is, as noted by the complexity on the back of the card, they're generally pretty on point. I think the goalpost shifted a little bit with Jagged Earth, but generally still on point.
So I think the last thing is that a lot of expansions need some sort of cohesive theme. This is marketing, which is weird to talk about in game design. It feels kind of dirty in a way, but like you want to let the players know what the expansion will add. And so you kind of want to pitch that to them, you know, with a theme. And I think expansions that don't have a theme tend to be just more of like the here's some more of the same that was in the base game, whereas having a theme can be kind of exciting, like, ooh, we're adding this to the game, or we're adding, you know, this special thing.
Mm-hmm.
It can really get players excited to play again because it's new. Again, it feels kind of weird to talk about because it feels very manipulative in some way, but the point I want to make is that Jagged Earth focuses on, like, Earth and the sky a lot, and, like, the air, but it doesn't have a lot of... I don't think it has any water directly, unless you count mist as being water.
Mm.
And this is genius to me, because we talked about, or you talked about, like, setting expectations. Having the name Jagged on the outside of your box, and then, like, having all the spirits look very dry and rough, or, like, intimidating, or, like, celestial, feels like they're trying to aesthetically imply that it's more complex and more rough than the base game.
Mm-hmm.
The base game feels more like primal nature, including all of the beauty of nature, but this is like the grit of nature, you know, volcanoes, fires, war.
I think I could see that. Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe there's something. I guess it does have a pretty shocking design to it. I think visually there may have been at least some way to unify it, but Spirit Island visually as itself is kind of just like a collage. I think it has an art style, but then they just kind of throw anything they want in there to, like, you know, the game's called Spirit Island, and what's on the cover? Spirits, islands. It's like everything: the sky, plants, ships, the ocean. Like, rather than focus on a moment, they just kind of throw, and they have all of the spirits' portraits on the front of the box, you know, rather than just one or two. So there's not really a lot of restraint there, which means there's not a lot to, like, make a unifying message. But I get your point. There definitely is sort of like a different texture to the spirits on the front of the game, the first Spirit Island game, versus the spirits depicted on the front of the Jagged Earth expansion. They've actually only depicted four on the front cover, because there's so many. I guess that's one thing. There's so many spirits, you can't show them all on the front.
I think
although jagged definitely is a good description, and it does set a bit of an expectation that, like, this game's going to be a little crazy.
Mm-hmm. I think in the end, sort of my last closing statement is just that I think it's a great expansion to look at in terms of if you don't know how to make an expansion, look at it. But also, it's fun to compare it with other games with, like, a lot of expansions to sort of see the same progression of complexity and theme and, like, you know, concepts in those other games.
Oh, I do want to point out the Branch and Claw cover art definitely has more of like a feeling to it. Sort of tries to convey an emotion that you're going to feel with this expansion, rather than it just show you everything, you know, rather than it's sort of like goes. I don't know how to explain it exactly. There's definitely an emotional feel to the Branch and Claw. It doesn't just present everything to you.
A vibe, you know, as they say.
A vibe. I was trying to avoid saying it, but definitely shows you a vibe rather than just what spirits are in the game. Anyways, yeah. That then concludes our discussion on Spirit Island, Branch and Claw, and Jagged Earth expansions. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
We'll see you next episode, which comes out in 2 weeks.
See you.